My name's Andrew Hunter. I'm the senior curator of the Art Gallery of Guelph, and I'm here today in Toronto speaking with
Arlene Chan.
And we've known each other for a while, and we met originally in relation to an exhibition about Lauren Harris that I was involved in at the Art Gallery of Ontario, and part of that was looking into the history of the Ward neighborhood and the history of Toronto and thinking about the history of Canada and all that gets, well, to use a phrase that's appropriate here, whitewashed out, left out. And so we started to talk about the history of your family and the history of the Chinese community in Canada. But before we get into that conversation, just tell us all a bit about who you are and how you ended up here today.
Yes. So I'm a third generation Chinese Canadian, born in Toronto and grew up here, and grew up actually in Chinatown. I retired 11 years ago working as a librarian for Toronto Public Library, and ever since my retirement, I've kind of tackled on writing, researching, leading tours of Chinatown, and just having a great time just immersing myself in the history of the Chinese in Toronto. It's a topic I've always loved since I was a kid, but now that I have so much more time on my hands, I've really gone very deep into this topic. So something that's very near and dear to my heart.
Right. How long did you work at the library?
30 years.
Right. And did you study library science? Or
yep.
How did?
Yeah. Yep. Okay. So I went to university. Well, I went to school in Toronto. Went to Ogden School and Ryerson School right downtown in Toronto. Finished high school, went to U of T and took an undergrad in English and psychology, mm-hmm. and then went to library school, so got my master's degree in library science. And in between that, I kind of took a year off and went to Europe and had my travel bug kind of worked out a bit. And when I came home and finished my studies, I was really ready to start working. And so I'm very, very lucky that I was in a field, because when I had my undergrad and I said, well, what can I do with a degree in English and psychology? And the answer was not very much. And so
I think that's an answer to like many people when they finish their degrees. What do I? And I'm just like, oh. Yeah.
So I said,
barista.
Well, yeah, right. That was something I looked at as well, because I certainly did some of that when I was working for a year in Europe. So I knew what I didn't want to be. And then I thought about it, and I said, you know, I love reading. I was one of those kids that when my parents had lights out, I'd be reading with a flashlight under my bed covers. And I love researching. So I said, library school, that would be, so I can use my four-year degree. And so that's what I did, and I don't have any regrets at all. Just working for Toronto Public Library, being there when it was first just for the city of Toronto, and then it was amalgamated, so it was this seven former library systems. I was there for the transition, helping the transition. Mm-hmm. So it was a very exciting time. And also when the library went from a manual system with card catalogs and then became automated, when the internet was first introduced, and I was on the training team, training staff. So I was there at sort of like the transition from the old way to the new way. So I was very, very lucky to be working there.
Yeah, I have to say, I often, in talking about curatorial work and museum work, often talk about how progressive libraries have been in understanding the shifts in technologies and knowledge, and really understanding fundamentally what they are.
Yeah, right? And for me, doing so much research, I remember the days when you would sit at an index table and go through year by year and writing down the names of newspaper articles and what year and magazine art, and then having the challenge of finding copies of newspapers and magazines. Now everything is, I mean, I am the biggest fan of the services of the Toronto Public Library. I mean, 24/7 access to old newspapers, magazines, university thesis, it's incredible. So I'm now, having worked for the library, now a user of the library services, and it's an incredible service.
I live in Hamilton, and Hamilton Public Library, they have 3D printers, they have recording studios, it's really, they've really taken to heart what that role of being a public space for access, right? Which is something museums need to learn a lot more about.
If you go to Toronto, any, Toronto Reference Library, any time that you go there, it's just packed with people. It's so relevant. Yeah. It's so needed by Toronto.
So, So let's talk, I think I'd like to talk about three things. I think I'd like to talk, obviously, about Chinese history in Toronto and Canada, and love to talk about your mom. and then just also talk about the books you've written. So maybe I think an interesting way to start would be to talk about your mother, because I think she is such a major influence on the path you chose, and also her experiences and your family experiences so much informed your interest in raising public knowledge about Chinese history in Canada. So talk about your mom, remarkable woman.
My mom, I mean, yes, she's my mom, and yes, she is remarkable, but not just because she's my mom, but because she was an extraordinary woman of her time. She was born in British Columbia, born in Nanaimo, a small mining town. And my grandfather, her father had come in 1899, so that's a long, long time ago. So when he came by himself, but he was one of the fortunate few Chinese men who was able to bring over his wife and his firstborn child.
That's unusual.
And so out of the family of 12, the firstborn was born in China. So when my grandfather came in 1899, he would have paid the $50 head tax. And when he brought my grandmother over a few years later, the tax had already doubled to $100.
Right.
And my grandfather was a farm laborer at first, and then he worked in the coal mines, but he was able to put together enough money to bring over his wife and his firstborn child, which was very unusual because at the worst of times, like, the ratio of men to women was like 30-1. Because of the head tax, because of the subsequent exclusionary law, there were very, very few women. So my grandfather was very lucky to have his family, his wife here, and the firstborn, and then after 11 more children were born in British Columbia. So my mom came from a very large family, and it was during that she went to a segregated school when she was growing up. So it was segregated.
In Nanaimo.
By the time she went, she was in a segregated school. This was in Vancouver.
Oh, okay.
So it was segregated for First Nations children, Japanese and Chinese. And so this was when it struck her, you know, why am I being treated so differently? Why am I outside the circle? I want to be with all these other children, because she would have to walk past the regular school to get to her school. And we'd be outside the fence looking in at these other children. She said, how can I be part of that? And this is something that really informed her work when she became an adult. This whole sense of, our Canadian life, why do we have all these separations? So when my mom was growing up, so she had to quit school at age 12 to help support the family, and this was again during the Depression years in the 30s, and eventually had to move as a 16-year-old, have to leave her family, come with an 8-year-old sister on the train across Canada, and landed in Toronto to work to help support the other siblings. And she worked for a year or so, and she's again showing the kind of extraordinary person she was. She started her own business, a grocery store. Did so well that she started bringing over her parents and her brothers and sisters to Toronto.
Where was that store?
In Toronto. There was one, that one would have been on St. Clair.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So all like downtown stores. So she borrowed $200 and then opened this grocery store. And so a few years later, after she brought over her parents and some of her brothers and sisters, my grandmother said to her, you know, you're 19 years old, it's time for you to get married. And so a matchmaker was found. And my father was very, very handsome when he was a young man, kind of looked like my mom's idol was Clark Gable, and I think my dad looked a lot like Clark Gable. So anyhow, they were matched together, and they got married at Knox Presbyterian Church, which is still there on Spadina and Harvard. And my mother said to the minister, I have to get married on Sunday. And the minister said, no, I don't do weddings on Sunday, because that's our church day, it's our busiest day. And my mother said, well, if I don't have my church wedding on Sunday, nobody's going to be able to come, because everybody's working on the other days. So an exception was made, and my mom got married at Knox Presbyterian Church on Sunday, because the custom back then was that you would have been married in your family association hall. So it would have been the Lem Family Association, because my mom was born a Wong, but then married my father, who's a Lem. So that should have been and she was dressed all in Western attire, so it was, and had all these bridesmaids and flower girl. it should have been a really happy occasion, but what happened to my mom was, because my father was born in China, and my father had paid the $500 head tax when he came to Canada. So my mother, even though she was born in Canada, she lost her citizenship, right, because she married my father, whose official status is alien.
Right.
And so she had to take on the official status of alien.
Right.
And the irony is that her having lost her citizenship, she and my father applied for their citizenship after the Second World War, and she eventually became a citizenship court judge. And so
right.
I think that's quite the circle there. But
and that legal issue around losing your status has its parallel in Indigenous communities, of Indigenous women marrying outside their community and losing their Indigenous status, official government.
Yeah, so this sort of added again to this thing about, you know, why am I being treated differently now? She was truly outside because she's now considered an alien. So anyhow, my parents were very, the Chinese community at the time they got married, there would have been about maybe 2,000 Chinese living in Toronto at the time. This is in the, my parents got married in 1939. A very small community, first because of the head tax, which was in effect from 1885 until 1923. And then the government said, this head tax isn't working. It's not stopping Chinese from coming into Canada. So they introduced the Chinese Immigration Act, which said no more Chinese can come in. So for 24 years until 1947, only a handful of Chinese came in under the few exemptions that were of Chinese allowed into Canada. And so the Chinese community was very, very small, very insular, because there was so much discrimination, even despite the fact 2,000 out of a total population, it's very small. And they were segregated in, of course, the ward, St. John's Ward, and that's where the Chinatown developed.
Which is where Nathan Phillips Square is now, and around Dundas and Spadina, Dundas and University kind of area.
So when my parents got married, the Chinatown there was very confined to that ward area, and there were, you know, laundries, restaurants, small businesses there, and the Chinese sort of kept to themselves because they, with the exception of the church, was the only non-Chinese organization that really reached out to the Chinese and offered English language classes. And my parents, the war was a turning point. The Second World War was a turning point for the Chinese community, because Canada and China were now allies against Japan. Many Chinese Canadian men and women volunteered to serve, even though it was very challenging for them to serve because they were turned away on many occasions. The Chinese raised a lot of money through the victory bonds and supported the war effort. So this really helped to turn the tide in terms of how Canadians felt about the Chinese community. So when the war ended, huge celebration on Elizabeth Street, the Chinese organized a parade. But that, what happened after the war, again, United Nations had this Declaration of Human Rights, and Canada looked at their human rights and looked and said, well, we're not treating the Chinese very well with this exclusionary law. So the law was repealed. The Chinese got the right to vote right across the country. That allowed them to go into professions like medicine and law. And so things really started looking up, except for in Toronto. Because what happened was, two-thirds of our Chinatown, our first Chinatown, was the land was expropriated to build New City Hall and the new public square. So my mother, at this point, both my parents were involved in the Chinese community, more so my father, because he was a man and there were very few women. And actually, when my mom arrived from BC and arrived in Toronto in the mid-30s, there were only about a dozen Chinese families. That's how few women there were. As a side, I always teased my father. I said, you know, you were matched up with mom. Do you know how lucky you were that with the ratio at the time was 18 men to one woman, and you lucked out and you got one of the women.
Yeah. And you came from outside,
and
too.
And you came from outside.
Yeah, you weren't one of the 18 already here.
And I said to my, my dad, he had a really good sense of humor, and he said, so his response was, well, there wasn't much choice then. He was stuck with my mother. But anyhow, so after the war, then two-thirds of Chinatown gets expropriated. And so my mother, she was at that time the president of the Women's Association for one of the Chinese dramatic societies. My father had already been the president of the Lem Family Association and was very involved with the Chinese Community Center of Ontario. But my parents opened a restaurant on Elizabeth Street, just on Elizabeth and Dundas, called the Kuang Chao Restaurant in 1959. And that was just when Chinatown, the land, was being expropriated, but their property, their business was just north of where everything was being demolished. And there was no community consultation. Like, this was at a time when the city didn't consult. I mean, it wasn't just for the Chinese community. It was just anybody. All around the city. And these buildings were being torn down left, right, and center without any consultation. So when City Hall opened in 1965, two-thirds of Chinatown had been expropriated. The Chinese community businesses, residents were forced to move, and that's when they started moving towards Spadina and Dundas. Following, when they moved into the ward, they were moving into buildings and homes left vacant by the Jewish community that had moved to Kensington Market. So this time, after the expropriation, they moved into the Spadina and Dundas area because the Jewish community there was starting to move up north. So it's a very interesting relationship there. So my parents opened the restaurant, the Kuang Chao Restaurant. 1965 comes around, City Hall's officially opened, and the City Hall said, we're going to start redeveloping the rest of what's left of Chinatown. And it was not only getting rid of what was left of Chinatown, but it was also a lot of discussion about, let's not have this designation Chinatown, because it's kind of like a ghetto or it's a rundown area. So my mother...
Because I think once we were talking before about how there was a real stigma about the neighborhood and going there, and then these restaurants, like the one your parents owned, really changed people's perspective after the war of something fancier.
Yes. So up until the Second World War, the Chinese restaurants were, it was primarily catering to the Chinese clientele and some Jewish actors, because the theater district was right next to the Chinatown, the vaudeville actors would go and eat in restaurants there. So it wasn't really a place, Chinatown was not a place that a respectable Torontonian would go and visit, and it was definitely not a tourist attraction. So when the city announced that it was going to do more land expropriation, my mother organized a Save Chinatown committee. Mm-hmm. And this was quite something for her to be a woman to do this, because, and how this happened was, in the late 50s, even though the Exclusion Act had been ended in 1947, you would have thought people would start applying to bring their families over from China. But what was happening was there was still a lot of clauses in immigration law that said, yes, you can start bringing your family over, but you have to be a Canadian citizen to apply. And very few Chinese were citizens because, well, first, like my mother, she lost her citizenship. Secondly, people had to apply, go to a judge, and the judge would say, in most cases, we don't think you should become a Canadian citizen. We don't think you fit into what we want as a citizen. So very few Chinese men were citizens, so they were not allowed to bring over their wives. So eventually that clause was removed from the immigration. And then the law was, your children have to be a certain age, or your parents have to. So there were all these restrictions. So my mother was, by accident, included in a delegation that went to Ottawa to meet with the Prime Minister to, lobby for more changes to ease family reunification. So my mother, this was when Prime Minister John Diefenbaker was first elected. So 1959, there was a change in government. And so a delegation wanted to go to meet the new Prime Minister. And the Member of Parliament was Roland Michener, advised this all-male delegation. These were men that were from across Canada, and not only Chinese, but also non-Chinese, who really felt strongly that this immigration law should be revised. he said, you really should include a woman in your delegation because this is a family issue. You're talking about bringing women and families over from China. So you should have a woman. And plus, Ellen Fairclough was the Minister of Immigration. She was the first female cabinet minister. For all these reasons, you should have a woman delegate. And so, and I think Jean Lum would be a suitable person to have.
Yeah.
So this all-male delegation said they weren't too pleased with this because, you know, this was something that was not the usual practice. And so they said they reluctantly agreed to have my mom come along. And they said to her, they gave her very explicit instructions. Yes, you can come. You have to sit there. Don't say a word. Be quiet as a mouse and sit in the back. So the delegation arrives and the Prime Minister, being the gentleman that he was, noticed that my mother's the only woman and said, I want you to sit right beside me. And then on his other side was the official spokesperson for the group, Mr. Wong Fun Sin, who was the one that was presenting the brief. And this is what we would like to have changed in the immigration laws. Well, throughout the entire presentation, Prime Minister Diefenbaker was leaning over to my mother and saying, and what did he say, and what did he say? And as it turns out, Prime Minister, nobody would have known at the time because he was newly elected. He was hard of hearing in one ear and hearing in the other ear. And he had my mother sit on his good ear side. So in the end, my mother was the one who saved the day. And from that point on, she became recognized as a spokesperson for the Chinese community. So when this whole Chinatown issue came up in Toronto of demolishing what was left of Chinatown, my mother headed up a Save Chinatown committee. And we're successful in halting further demolition of Chinatown. And also for retaining the designation of the term Chinatown as well, and extending the boundary for what the city thought was Chinatown from what was the ward,
right.
College Street, Queen Street, University, and Yonge Street, and extended that boundary on University all the way over to Bathurst Street, which is why we now have our thriving Chinatown West at Spadina Dundas. So my mother, with the restaurant, there were what we call the Big Four restaurants. And these restaurants were these post-war restaurants were very, very different from the earlier Chinese restaurants in Chinatown because they, you know, they were large, over 100 seats. They had tablecloths, they had uniformed waiters, wait staff, and English-speaking people, Chinese people who were there working. And so there was Kwong Chau Restaurant, my parents' restaurant, Lychee Garden, Nanking Restaurant, and Sai Ru Restaurant. And just speaking about my own parents' restaurant, is these were so important in helping to change people's attitude, because you can change laws, you can change policies, but the hardest thing to change are people's opinions and stereotypes of people. So what these restaurants did was they really introduced Canadian society to Chinese culture through food. And that's when we started seeing what we call Chinese-Canadian food become very popular.
Right.
And, you know, people today, when you look at the kind of Chinese food you can get today, which is, you know, real food, authentic Chinese food, they kind of make fun of Chinese-Canadian food. It says, oh, that's not, you know, Chinese food. Because if you go to China and ask for an egg roll or a fortune cookie, they kind of, what is that?
Yeah.
So, but this food, what Chinese food was adapted for Western palate, and that's why it became so popular. And so these Chinese restaurants became a destination, and then Chinatown became a destination.
Right.
So people started going to Chinese restaurants. And not only that, it was politicians. These are the important policy, the lawmakers from City Hall, from the legislative building, which is, you know, all close to Chinatown. They were going to these restaurants.
Oh, right. Yeah,
and
yeah.
That's where, you know, it was all so important for people to realize that Chinese are like everybody else. And so all of this was very important to help to turn people's opinions about the Chinese in Toronto. And so my mom, her mentor was, one of her mentors was Pauline McGibbon, who later became the first female lieutenant governor in Ontario. And she said to my mother, you know, Jean, you've done so much work in the Chinese community, and now it's really important, again, talking about this transition, that you start going outside the Chinese community. So my mother started speaking to groups about Chinese culture, Chinese history, and just having my mother, again, she's born in Toronto, in Canada, speaking, here's this Chinese woman speaking English so well, really, and because she was such a personable person, so warm, so such a lovely person, there was something very magnetic about her that people just were entranced, and she was an excellent speaker. So she started going out and speaking to groups, and then she started getting appointed as the first woman, Chinese woman, on the board of governor for Women's College Hospital for University Settlement. Like, she started achieving all these firsts because it was very unusual for a Chinese woman to be involved in non-Chinese organizations. So in 1976, my mother became the first Chinese Canadian woman to be inducted into the Order of Canada, which was a huge, huge event. And after that point, she just kept doing all these first to do this and first to do that. So the impact of my mother's work is, yes, she was involved in helping to stop, you know, the demolition of Chinatown, not only in Toronto, but she was invited to help save other Chinatowns across Canada. Also in her work in helping to change Canada's immigration laws, which wasn't until 1967, 20 years after the repeal of the Exclusion Act, that any clauses that were negatively having an impact on the Chinese immigrants was removed. So it took 20 years. Her work in really changing people, making Chinese more accepted into Canadian life, that was the kind of impact that she had. So I'm so proud of my mom, all her achievements. A Heritage Ontario plaque has been installed in Chinatown in her memory. And the biggest, most recent honor, I mean, she passed away in 2002, so here we are in 2018, but next year, the Toronto District School Board's newest school is going to be called Jean Lum Public School.
That's amazing.
It's really...
Where is that school?
It's at the foot of Spadina, around Lakeshore.
Oh, perfect. Yeah, so right in the heart of
and
the city.
And it's in
yeah.
the same grouping of schools where I went to public school.
Right.
And we lived right in the same area. So it's just, and I went to an information meeting for this new school, and I've never heard my mother's name spoken so much. Like, oh, are you going to the Jean Lum? Are you going to Jean Lum? You know, it's
right.
just like,
yeah.
The other thing that's another legacy, it's not only this heritage plaque but and the school, but also there's been a foundation that's been established, the Jean Lum Foundation. Yeah. Awards are given to recognize high school students of Chinese heritage.
Right.
And so up until last year, these awards were given locally, like to students in the GTA. But starting this year, in our 21st year, and I'm the president of the Jean Lum Foundation, we're going to be giving out the applications will be accepted from across Canada. So it's
oh,
huge.
Wonderful.
It's
yeah,
just
yeah,
huge.
Yeah. And that's for high school age
high
students.
School,
okay.
Yes. Yeah. So her legacy is living on because she is such an amazing role model. Because I have to say, when I was growing up and the reading that I did, I would go to the library and I'd be looking in the library for books about Chinese Canadians and found nothing.
Right.
And I think it's so important for young people to have a role model to see that I can do this too. I can accomplish what, you know, all these amazing things. And that's what's happening, these young people that are coming up now.
Yeah.
So my mom's legacy is living on, even though she passed on a while ago now.
So let's pause so you can drink some of your tea
and
your croissant, or no, you're having a scone. And a quick side story, when you're talking about John Diefenbaker, I was fortunate when I was quite young, I lived in Hamilton, my mom was president of the Canadian Hearing Society.
Okay.
And there was an event in Hamilton where John Diefenbaker, he was quite elderly at the time, had come to visit. And so they invited folks from the community to come and have tea with him. And so my mom brought me with her. And it was I remember, I didn't really know who he was.
Yes.
But it's also where I got to meet Lincoln Alexander.
Yes.
And so I tend to remember that moment as about Lincoln Alexander more than John Diefenbaker, but...
Yeah, my mother knew John Lincoln Alexander. He was such a gentleman, as was John Diefenbaker. I met him on several occasions, and Mrs. Diefenbaker as well. It's a whole different era of politician.
Just so folks know, it's a little noisy. We're sitting in a coffee shop in Toronto, which I'm sure is the kind of place your mom would have liked because it's so busy and people and...
People socializing and talking to each other.
And eating. Yeah. It was a good transition because you talk about your mother's legacy and your experience growing up of going to libraries and trying to find things and seeing nothing. And so I think about the work you've done speaking and writing and books as both as a kind of mentorship to a new generation, but also providing people with material about themselves. So when you go to the library, you can find yourself and your culture and your history. Talk about your first book, or when you did it come from being in the library? Like when you first went to the library, were you looking for things, or was it to fill that void?
Yeah, I got into writing very, very accidentally, and again related very closely with my mom. So what happened was a publisher had commissioned somebody to write a book, a children's book about my mother, because up at that point, if that would have been in the 80s, there was a lot written about my mother, but it was in newspapers and magazines, and then excerpts in various books. So this publisher had in mind to write a children's book, knowing that there's a huge gap in the children's collections on visible minority outstanding people. And it wasn't proceeding as quickly as he wanted. So he said to my mother, he said, you know, Jean, I know you have a daughter. She's a librarian. Do you think she might be interested in taking on this project? And my mother's immediate response was, oh, no. She's working full-time at the library. She's raising a young family. And her husband works in the food and hospitality industry, so he's not home. So it's, you know, she's very busy. So when she told me that, I just sort of went, Mom, like, this is a door opening. Yes, I'm really, really busy, but how often do you get this opportunity? So I contacted the publisher and I said, well, why don't I write one chapter, and if you like it, then I'll proceed. And it might take me a little while, but I'd love to take this project on. And if you don't like it, then I totally understand. Well, he liked it. And so then I took on this book, to write the book. And it was so interesting to do it because I'd heard the stories about my mom over and over again, but now writing the book, I had to really ask her in more detail and take notes and be really diligent about getting all the details. So anyhow, that first book was written, and it was called The Spirit of the Dragon, because I really feel that my mother, the symbol of the Chinese in China and the emperors, is the dragon. Yeah. And I just felt that my mother had that same sense of strength and power that the dragon symbolizes for China all these hundreds of years. So I called The Spirit of the Dragon, The Story of Jean Lum, a Proud Chinese Canadian. It's a long title, but I just felt this is what I want. And so when I finished that book, my publisher said, would you be interested in writing a book about a Chinese festival? Because there's very little tons of books on Chinese New Year, but nothing about...
Again, for like a children's youth
book.
Audience?
Yep. Yeah, okay. Youth audience. Yeah. And so I said, yes. And so I did the Mid-Autumn Festival. And there was nothing in English. And so fortunately for me, my husband reads and writes Chinese. So I would borrow books in Chinese from the library, and he would translate for me. Right. And so that's how I wrote my second book, The Mid-Autumn Festival. And when I finished that one, the publisher said, well, how about another book? So I started doing research on the Dragon Boat Festival.
Right.
And when I was doing my research, a friend of mine was on a dragon boat team, and I said, oh, I'm just doing all this research, and again, would be a children's book. And I said, is it possible for me to jump in the back of the boat? And I said, you know, I've done canoeing, you know, I've done gunnel jumping, so I'm not worried, I'm not afraid of water, I'm a great swimmer.
I'm sorry, you've done gunnel jumping?
You stand on the gunnels and you jump off the canoe and then you get back. So I'd done all that. So
I've never done that.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I've fallen out of canoes many times, but I've never never got old Joan.
Yeah. So she said, oh, yeah. So I sat in a dragon boat, and I had never been in one. I mean, I did all this research that I know there are 10 rows of seats, and you sit in pairs, and so I sat in the back seat, row 10. And I'm telling you, that experience, I'll never forget that experience, because it was nothing like canoeing.
Right.
And it was very exhilarating. And so I got hooked on, that's how I started dragon boats. I eventually joined a team, and eventually I was on two Canadian national
wow.
teams competing in Hungary and down in the States. So it became something that just grabbed me. But so anyhow, so getting back to my book, so I finished that book. And then another publisher approached me and said, you know, we're a Canadian publisher, Dundurn, and our specialty is Canadian history, and also we have this kind of niche thing for water sports, like sailing and canoeing, like canoe trips. Would you, and there's nothing been written about dragon boating, so would you be interested? And this would be for adults.
Right.
And so I took on that project. So it's just sort of one thing led to another, and I'm...
Yeah.
Very, very lucky that I never had to send a manuscript anywhere and ask. And so doing the dragon boat was called Dragon Boating in Canada, Paddles Up. And so after I finished that book for adults, then the publisher, this Dundurn publisher said to me, would you be interested in doing a book about the history of the Chinese in Toronto?
Well, yeah.
And there was nothing. I mean, there were, you know, academic works.
Yeah, you'd find like maybe a thesis or something. Yeah.
One book had been written, but again, it was an academic book by Richard Thompson. So I said, yeah, sure. So I did that book as well. And then after I finished that book, and that was for adults, then the public Dundurn said, well, can you do the same topic, but this time gear it for a younger audience, like grade 7, grade 8.
Mm-hmm.
So I did that one. So it's just sort of one thing led to another. And then the last book that I published was book number 7, and it was about the head tax and Chinese immigration,
right.
And it was for right across Canada. So that was another publisher, James Lorimer. So I have published 7 books. I'm working on book number 8 now. And it's going to be about historic Chinatown. So it's not going to be, and it's for the 3 Chinatowns that are in the city of Toronto. So Chinatown West, our first Chinatown, and Chinatown East.
Which is on the other side of the Don Valley, right?
Yeah. Like it's at Broadview and
right.
Girard.
Yeah.
And so this is not going to be, you know, these are the best restaurants to eat or the best store to buy your herbs or, you know, that kind of book. It's more like, standing right here, this used to be this, or this is this restaurant now, but it used to be this restaurant.
Right.
So it's a very historical kind of book. And it's going to be a while, and I'm loving doing the research. But
how much of that research is taking you into archives, and how much of that research is taking you to people and families?
It's both. Yeah. Because there's not a lot in the archives, so you have to rely a lot on people's stories and people's own personal files. So the Toronto Public Library, of course, has recently started a fantastic initiative called Chinese Canadian Archive, and I was one of the advisors for that project. And they are going to be collecting documents, photographs, any archival material that they're going to house at the Toronto Reference Library. And so they started this, I think it was launched 2 years ago now, I kind of lose track of time, but I think it was 2 years ago. And that's where I'm going to be eventually putting my mother's records are going to go there. Right now, there's not really one spot for people to do research. They have to kind of go all over the place. And so this Chinese Canadian Archive is the start of something really important. Right now, it's a lot of family stories. And that was the amazing thing when I was writing my book about the history of the Chinese in Toronto, is that I was researching people, and I knew these people. They were my uncle, whatever, or my auntie, or I was having all these aha moments of, oh, that's what he was doing. I didn't know, because I was just a kid going to all these community events with my parents and not knowing what the role of everybody was. Like, for example, Doc Yip, who was the first Chinese Canadian lawyer in Canada, had his office on Elizabeth Street near Dundas Street. And like Doc Yip, I remember meeting him, and I know his children, but he had a very thick accent when he spoke English, and I couldn't understand it because I knew he was born in Canada, and I couldn't put two and two. Then, as I was doing my research and talking to his family members, he was born in Vancouver, but because Chinatown was so segregated, the kids stayed in Chinatown.
They never spoke English.
They didn't speak English. Uh-huh. And so when he learned English, it was very heavily. It was as if he was born in China. So these are the kind of aha moments I was having. Or when I was researching Jimmy Lohr, who opened the Jingmo Martial Arts Club on Hagerman Street. He was the brother of Dr. Henry Lohr, who was a Chinese doctor who had an office on Dundas and Bay Street. But Jimmy Lohr opened Jingmo Kung Fu Club. And he was actually, when he tried to enlist in for World War II, he was turned down.
Right.
And here was this martial artist, and they turned him down because they didn't think he's suitable to serve and serve Canada. So he started, he had this martial arts school, and Elvis Stoico, who's a champion Canadian skater, and I don't know if you remember, but...
Oh yeah, he got really into Kung Fu.
He's very into martial arts, and his skate program, he used the music from the soundtrack, the movie about Bruce Lee, and turns out Elvis Stoico studied with Jimmy Lohr at the Jingmo, and I said, I studied there when I was just a kid, and I remember going to the lessons and what we had to do there. So I would have all these like aha moments, and like I would be so excited, like researching things and finding tidbits of information. I get all excited, and I'd run out of my little office at my house and run over and tell Leo, my husband. And I said, guess what? And he, you know, his answer was, oh, that's nice. You know? it just this is what I find so exciting. That's why I'm so passionate about this research, because I'm constantly finding things that you're not going to find in archives. It's like it's just talking to families, and I have so many connections in the community, and because I just have to say either my father's name or my mother's name in Chinese, and the door opens.
Right.
And this is not what usually happens. If you're a stranger knocking on the door of a family association, you want to go in and take pictures, they're not going to welcome you. But when I say my parents' name, then the door opens.
Yeah. Well, I certainly experienced that when we were working on the Harris Project, and wanting to learn more about the neighborhoods and the history, and you were incredibly generous about opening some of the doors and establishing some of those conversations that, and people responded very generously as well.
Yes, yes. And again, it's because of my parents and...
Didn't we find, we found pictures of your parents or your grandparents?
My grandparents at the Wong Association.
Yeah. Back in the kitchen.
Well, it was, I was all excited about that because my mom is a Wong. So when she arrived in Toronto, she would have gone to the Wong Association because, see, there were no support services for the Chinese before Second World War. So that's why the Chinese were so insular. They relied on their association. So membership was if you had the shared surname. So the Wongs had their association, the Lums had their association, and so on. Or it's based on where you were born, what village you're from. And then also a political association. The Wong Association, which used to be in the first Chinatown on Dundas Street near Bay, they eventually moved over to Spadina and Dundas. And they own a three-story building, and the first and second floor they rent out to retail stores, and that's how they make money. And the third floor is where their association hall is. So all these years, I've been going to the Wong Association, the association hall. And then when I was with you and they took me to the back room, which was kind of like a storage area near the kitchen or something, and there were two large
big images
of my grandparents.
Yeah.
And I said, I never knew, because they, of course, in the main hall, they had all these other photographs.
Yeah.
But this back room had another group of photographs, and that's where my grand. So again, it's discovering something like that.
Yeah,
you were there when I went, oh my God.
So we'll just wrap up. I wanted two quick things. One is, what do you have left from your parents' restaurant?
Well, the restaurant closed in, my parents sold it, 1985. They sold the restaurant. And the restaurant is still there. The building is one of the few buildings left on it's on the southwest corner of Elizabeth and Dundas.
Right.
It's a two-story building. It's one of the only buildings left in Chinatown from the old days. And there's another restaurant there now called Yotdong Restaurant.
Right.
And
it's a Hakka
restaurant.
Yeah, it's one of the, I go there, I used to go there all the time.
Yeah, it's very, very good. It's a family that's running that business. Yeah. They've been there for quite some time now. I love going there. Like recently I did an interview, a lunch crawl with Corey Mintz, who wrote an article for Toronto Life magazine. We went on a lunch crawl to kind of show the different cuisines that there are in Chinatown. We went to the Kwong Chau restaurant because that's where my parents had their restaurant. And so I go there often as part of a tour or interviews, and family are thrilled because there's this history associated. So the building is still there, and when I walk into the restaurant, of course it's been totally renovated, but still the same when you walk in there, it's just that familiarity.
They have the best green beans.
Oh, they have the best green beans.
They have really good
green beans. Have very good food there.
Yeah. But do you have anything yourself at home or whatever that comes from it, menu, things that were, or basically is that...
No, I have one menu from the restaurant, and then that's it. I have lots of pictures.
So the last thing I wanted to ask you was, you told me a story once about when you were quite young, going to see Chinese opera on Queen. But it was in a particular place that was not built originally for Chinese opera. If you could tell that story, and then we'll wrap up.
Well, I did a lot of tap dancing and Chinese dancing when I was a kid growing up. And on Sundays, when Toronto the Good, everything was closed on Sundays. And there was a venue on Queen Street, right across the street from New City Hall, where the Sheraton Hotel is. It was the Casino Burlesque Theater, which, of course, was infamous in its time for striptease shows. But it was closed on Sundays, and so the Chinese community would rent it, and then they would have Chinese performances, Chinese music, and show Chinese films there on Sundays. And so I was a little kid, there were six kids in my family, so I have three older brothers, two younger sisters, so three boys, three girls. And my mother had arranged someone to choreograph a dance piece, a tap dancing. So my three brothers would come out first. This is on the stage of the casino. Would come out and do this thing. And then I would come out, the first daughter. And then second sister would come out. And then my youngest sister at the time, I remember she was like 3 or 4 years old. I remember my mother literally had to push her on the stage because she was like, had total stage fright. She was like scared. So we used to perform on the stage of the casino. And when Chinatown moved from the first location at Elizabeth and Dundas, and then moved to Spadina and Dundas, of course the casino was eventually closed and torn down to build the Sheraton Hotel. Then the Victory Blessed was the second place that the Chinese would rent on Sundays.
Right, that's at Dundas and Spadina. The building's there,
there, which used to be
a vaudeville theater.
It was vaudeville, it was the Standard, and then it was the Strand, and then it was the Victory Blessed. So I also performed on the stage of the Victory Blessed.
Well, on that note. Well, I want to thank you again. It's been a pleasure to talk to you. We've talked lots of times, but you were very generous a few years ago, and it's been really nice to see you again.
Well, it was my honor to be asked by you to help in terms of that Lauren Harris exhibit, and how you really wanted to get... It wasn't just Lauren Harris painting in the community, but what was it like for people living there? What was going on in the community? And connecting group of seven artists with what was really going on. That was.
And then as we began this conversation about, thinking about issues around Canada's history of ignoring people's histories of racers, of cultures, and histories, that seemed deeply relevant in thinking about a figure like Lauren Harris and the Group of Seven that have really done a lot to establish a very particular idea of Canada, which kind of overwrites so much history. So
I thank you for including me in that great project, and also it's been great to know you and keep our connection up, even though that was a while ago now, a few years ago.
Well, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Yeah.